The story of Adnan Syed from the podcast Serial haunts our collective conscience. Convicted of murdering his ex-girlfriend despite weak evidence, Syed's defense lawyer, Christina Gutierrez, performed abysmally, missing key alibi witnesses, showing poor organization, and repeatedly demanding money from his family. Later disbarred for mishandling client funds, Gutierrez exemplifies a broken system where even those with legal representation often receive inadequate service. This case isn't an anomaly. It's a window into America's dysfunctional justice system. Rebooting justice has become required reading in law schools nationwide and has been praised by Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor as a necessary wake-up call. The book challenges conventional wisdom about America's access to justice crisis. While we have more lawyers per capita than any other nation, the World Justice Project ranks America 27th in civil justice and 22nd in criminal justice globally. How can a country with so many legal professionals leave so many citizens without meaningful access to justice? The answer lies in a system designed by lawyers for lawyers, complex procedures that make navigation expensive, bar authorities that restrict competition from paralegals, and a structure that advantages those with better representation. Despite Gideon v. Wainwright's promise of counsel for indigent defendants, the reality falls devastatingly short of the ideal. The reality for poor defendants is stark. Criminal defense is radically underfunded compared to prosecution resources. This creates larger caseloads, fewer investigatory resources, and much lower salaries for public defenders. The result is systematic, ineffective assistance of counsel across the country. This isn't just a few bad apples. The system forces appointed defense lawyers to plea out cases quickly with minimal investigation. New Orleans public defender Rick Tysier had to handle 418 defendants, including many serious felonies, in just 7 months, leading a judge to quip, "Not even a lawyer with an S on his chest could effectively handle this docket." Courts have established a shockingly low bar for adequate representation. The mirror test for competent counsel persists. If the court-appointed lawyer's breath fogs a mirror, that's considered sufficient. Defense attorneys who show up drunk, fall asleep during trial, or use drugs have been allowed to continue representing defendants in serious cases, even capital trials. In one shocking example, Judy Haney faced the death penalty while her lawyer was held in contempt for showing up drunk, yet the judge let him continue the next day. Even in capital cases, defense lawyers fail to find alibi witnesses, gather medical records, or present mitigating evidence. Some lawyers have referred to their own clients using racial slurs. The consequences are devastating. Jimmy Ray Bromgard served 14 years for a rape he didn't commit because his appointed lawyer, Jailhouse John Adams, did virtually nothing, meeting him once, hiring no experts, filing no motions, and failing even to appeal. Courts routinely find such representation adequate. This crisis affects everyone, not just those charged with serious crimes. Even common charges like DUIs carry severe consequences: mandatory fines, jail time, and license suspension, with technical defenses beyond most defendants' abilities. Private representation costs thousands, yet most middle-class earners make too much to qualify for appointed counsel. To understand our current situation, we must examine the history of criminal procedure and the right to appointed counsel. Until the mid-18th century, English defendants couldn't hire defense counsel in routine felony cases. As prosecuting attorneys emerged, courts allowed defendants to hire lawyers to level the playing field. After the Revolutionary War, the Sixth Amendment guaranteed the right to have the assistance of counsel, understood as the right to hire one's own lawyer, not receive one for free. Throughout the 19th century, as the legal system professionalized with police forces and public prosecutors, some states began appointing counsel for capital or felony cases, though often unpaid. The watershed moment came with Powell v. Alabama, 1932, the Scottsboro Boys case, where 9 young black men faced death sentences for rape charges based on flimsy evidence. the Supreme Court overturned their convictions, finding that in capital cases, courts must appoint counsel for defendants who cannot afford their own. This ruling represented the first time the court used the Bill of Rights to overturn a state criminal conviction. Over decades, this right expanded incrementally. In Betts v. Brady, 1942, the court refused to extend this right to all state criminal trials, holding that counsel was only required in special circumstances. Over time, the court increasingly found such circumstances in routine cases, making case-by-case determinations impractical. In 1963, Gideon v. Wainwright overruled Betts. Clarence Gideon, convicted of breaking into a pool hall based on questionable testimony, successfully argued that the Sixth Amendment's right to counsel is fundamental. Justice Black emphasized that in our adversary system, lawyers are necessities, not luxuries. When retried with appointed counsel, Gideon was quickly acquitted. The court later extended this right to misdemeanors, resulting in imprisonment, Argensinger v. Hamlin, and even suspended sentences that might later result in jail time, Alabama v. Shelton. However, the court drew the line at cases imposing actual imprisonment rather than just fines, Scott v. Illinois, citing concerns about imposing substantial costs on 50 quite diverse states. While the right to counsel became broad in scope, the court refused to make it deep in substance. The vagueness of standards and strong presumption of effectiveness make it extremely difficult to review convictions. Courts rarely intervene in systemic problems like underfunding and excessive caseloads, as they're poorly equipped to manage budgets. Civil courts present equally significant access to justice problems that affect millions of Americans annually. While some simple legal matters can be handled without attorneys through self-help resources, many civil issues require sophisticated legal expertise that's unaffordable to most middle and working-class people. Using divorce cases as an example, only the simplest uncontested divorces without children, property disputes, or pension retirement considerations can be handled with self-help forms. Even then, mistakes in paperwork can lead to significant delays and complications. Legal aid services are severely limited in scope and availability, typically only helping those below 125% of the federal poverty line and prioritizing emergency cases involving domestic abuse, imminent eviction, or denial of benefits. Many legal aid offices maintain waiting lists spanning several months. This leaves most Americans with complex legal needs unable to afford representation, forcing them to lump it, either abandoning valid legal claims or accepting unfavorable terms that can have long-lasting financial and personal consequences. The statistics paint a stark picture of this crisis. 75% of family matters in Maine courts, 88% of tenants facing eviction in New York City Housing Court, and 80% of California family law cases involve at least one unrepresented party. These rates have skyrocketed since the 1970s, when unrepresented parties were rare exceptions rather than the norm. In landlord-tenant cases, the disparity is particularly pronounced. While most landlords have legal representation, fewer than 10% of tenants do in most jurisdictions. Comprehensive studies from 7 states reveal that low-income households face up to 3 significant legal needs yearly, with fewer than 1 in 5 ever addressed by a lawyer. The attorney-to-client ratio highlights this inequality. There is only 1 legal aid attorney per 6,415 poor people, compared to 1 private attorney per 429 people in the general population. This disparity creates a 2-tiered system of justice where legal representation becomes a luxury rather than a right. While many law firms advertise seemingly affordable legal services like $500 divorces or bankruptcy for $999, these teaser rates apply only to the simplest uncontested cases with no complications. Contested divorces quickly become unaffordable, with hourly billing rates ranging from $200 to $500 per hour and substantial upfront retainers, often $10,000 or more for a typical contested case. Pro bono options are limited, especially for family law matters, as few lawyers have the necessary expertise or can afford to take on complex cases without compensation. Court staff face strict limitations on assistance they can provide, as clerks' offices are forbidden from giving legal advice to avoid unauthorized practice of law claims. This creates a catch-22 where those most in need of guidance cannot receive it from court personnel. Even seemingly simple issues like filing for divorce across state lines or determining proper jurisdiction for child custody matters become insurmountable procedural hurdles for pro se litigants. The complexity of legal forms, filing deadlines, and procedural rules often require professional guidance that remains out of reach for most Americans. Like criminal law, civil procedures and laws in the 18th and 19th centuries were simple enough for literate Americans to represent themselves. Early American justice was remarkably accessible. Law and procedure were simple enough that literate citizens could represent themselves competently in court. During the Jacksonian era, governments actively deprofessionalized courts and the legal profession as part of a broader attack on cultural elites. Several states abolished court appearance requirements entirely, and by 1860, only 9 of 39 states required preparation periods for bar admission, down from 14 of 19 in 1800. From the 1880s onward, however, civil courts became increasingly lawyer-dominated. Urbanization, industrialization, and immigration drove America's increasing reliance on formal legal structures. Negligent suits against factories, railroads, and streetcars surged, while statutes, regulations, and common law doctrines multiplied. Simultaneously, bar associations, judges, and law professors professionalized the legal system, making court procedures so formal that only trained lawyers could navigate them. Between 1880 and 1950, barriers to entering the legal profession rose dramatically. Law schools replaced apprenticeships, ABA-approved schools replaced night schools, and formal written bar examinations replaced informal interviews. This professionalization devastated immigrants and the poor, who faced predatory landlords, employers, and lenders without legal recourse. In response, charitable legal aid societies formed to help the deserving poor and eventually became government programs. But they've never come close to meeting the needs of the poor, let alone the middle class. After shrinking during the Depression and World War II, the legal profession experienced explosive growth from the late 1940s through the 1980s. The War on Poverty formalized previously independent legal aid offices through federal funding. By 1972, annual funding reached $71.5 million, supporting both individual representation and broader law reform efforts. After controversies like Governor Reagan's attempt to block funding to California Rural Legal Assistance following a successful Medicaid lawsuit, Congress established the Independent Legal Services Corporation in 1974, which achieved its minimum access goal of 2 lawyers per 10,000 poor persons by 1981. Since the 1980s, access to justice problems have expanded beyond just the poor to affect middle-class Americans as well. Reagan's election brought an abrupt end to LSC's brief period of full funding, resulting in a 25% cut between 1981 to 82 that closed nearly 200 offices and reduced staff by a third. Legal aid funding has steadily declined since the 1990s, down 63% from its 1980s peak. If everyone agrees we have a problem, why does it keep worsening? Multiple factors contribute. The time and expense of legal education, our adversarial system's expectation that each side hires capable representation, legislative indifference to funding free lawyers, judicial hesitation to order specific funding levels, and the fact that high defense caseloads and low funding are key ingredients in America's plea-driven system. Public choice theory helps explain why justice systems remain broken despite well-meaning participants. Unlike traditional views that government actors primarily serve the public good, public choice assumes they rationally pursue self-interest. While judges, lawyers, and other justice system participants consciously want to improve access to justice, unconscious incentives drive them to maintain systems that minimize pressure on repeat players. American lawyers uniquely regulate themselves through state supreme courts rather than legislatures, claiming inherent authority despite historically shared regulation. This self-governance insulates the profession from public oversight. State Supreme Court justices are all former lawyers who naturally sympathize with the profession's interests. The result? A profession that's extremely difficult to enter, requiring undergraduate degrees, 3 years of ABA-accredited law school, character examinations, and multiple exams, but remarkably easy to remain in, with weak disciplinary systems that dismiss most complaints. This self-regulation makes potential solutions like creating legal nurse practitioner equivalents or loosening unauthorized practice restrictions highly unlikely. Legislators avoid funding legal aid because money is scarce and powerful interest groups oppose it. Criminal defense funding also consistently lags behind prosecution, police, and jail budgets, partly because many Americans believe the system is already too lenient. Judges cannot typically order legislatures to make budgetary decisions except in extreme circumstances. The current system creates a two-tier justice system where wealthy defendants can afford thorough case preparation and drive harder plea bargains, while poor defendants receive assembly line justice. As Judge Richard Posner cynically but accurately observes, this bare-bones system may be optimal from an economic perspective. It keeps wrongful convictions relatively low without requiring excessive resources. Despite these challenges, technology is revolutionizing access to justice. Colin Rule's eBay and PayPal online dispute resolution, ODR system, handles over 40 million annual disputes with remarkable efficiency. Despite challenges like passionate disputants with no ongoing relationships and the impossibility of human mediation for every case, Rule developed a staircase approach that resolves issues before they become formal disputes. The system begins with automated problem solving, followed by computer-driven negotiation, with human intervention only as a last resort. This approach settles approximately 90% of disputes without human input, saves millions in customer service costs, and remarkably increases customer satisfaction and retention even among those who lose their disputes. Legal technology startups are flourishing, with venture capital investment jumping from $66 million in 2012 to $458 million in 2013. Unlike traditional legal services that chase lucrative corporate work, these startups target the underserved poor and middle-class market with low-cost solutions. The digital revolution has transformed access to legal materials. Just 150 years ago, even lawyers and judges struggled to gather applicable case law and statutes. The true breakthrough came when governments and nonprofits, like the Legal Information Institute, began offering free online access to statutes, regulations, and cases. Technology has also revolutionized access to legal documents through free court forms, pro bono.net resources, and low-cost providers. Courts nationwide now offer downloadable forms with instructions for common legal needs. California's online self-help center attracted over 4 million visitors in 2010 alone, while the National Center for State Courts links to free forms from 49 states. The A2J author platform takes this further by creating interactive interviews that guide users through form completion in plain language, with helpful pop-ups and multimedia explanations. New York State's implementation of A2J has been particularly successful, generating over 100,000 court documents in 2012 despite budget cuts. The legal services market has transformed into a spectrum of options at different price points. LegalZoom offers interactive forms like Living Wills, $39, Last Wills, $69, and Living Trusts, $249, with the process being simple and quick. For contested matters like bankruptcy, these services typically steer users toward traditional lawyers at higher fees. LegalZoom and Rocket Lawyer have moved towards subscription models, with LegalZoom offering Legal Advantage Plus Attorney Plan for as low as $9.99 monthly for unlimited attorney support, while Rocket Lawyer charges $39.95 monthly after a free trial week. Judge Fern Fisher exemplifies the fight to reform America's courts for unrepresented litigants. A Harvard Law graduate who began as a Harlem legal aid lawyer in Manhattan's housing court, Fisher witnessed firsthand how the system favored landlords with attorneys against unrepresented tenants who often unknowingly waived their rights. After becoming a housing court judge in 1989, she ensured fair treatment for all litigants and eventually rose to lead New York State's Access to Justice program. Under her leadership, New York adopted the A2J online document platform, creating court kiosks and later online systems to help tenants file answers to eviction actions. The most basic form of pro se assistance is providing information to litigants through websites, videos, and forms. The Indiana Supreme Court's YouTube channel has over 129 videos explaining court processes that have been viewed over 360,000 times. California Supreme Court's self-help website features 900-plus pages of forms and resources used by 100,000-plus people monthly. Court clerks typically refuse to answer legal questions from pro se litigants, citing ethics codes and unauthorized practice of law concerns. California leads reform with self-help centers in every county staffed by dedicated personnel like family law facilitators. San Diego and Sacramento offer one-day divorce programs when spouses agree on terms. American judges, as former lawyers accustomed to cases with legal representation, often struggle with pro se litigants. Their judicial independence and conservative adherence to precedent make courts resistant to change. Two seminal works, the American Judicature Society's Reaching Out or Overreaching and Richard Zorza's The Self-Help Friendly Court, argue judges can ethically assist pro se litigants. A more radical redesign would adopt an inquisitorial approach where judges and clerks take greater control, significantly helping unrepresented litigants. This approach already exists in American small claims courts and administrative proceedings, settings where empirical research shows lawyers make little difference in outcomes. Online dispute resolution, ODR technology, can resolve disputes with minimal human involvement, particularly for common case types with recurring issues and settlements. Pro se court cases are well suited for ODR since divorce, child support, evictions, and consumer debt follow predictable patterns. The American lawyer's monopoly operates through two mechanisms: unauthorized practice of law, UPL restrictions that prevent outsiders from providing legal services, and extensive barriers to entry, including expensive education and licensing requirements. These protections far exceed what's needed for consumer safety, effectively creating a Cadillac or nothing model that makes legal services unaffordable for many Americans. America's legal education system demands the highest standards at enormous cost. Unlike countries where law can be studied as an undergraduate degree, American lawyers must first complete a bachelor's degree, then spend 3 more years and often $200,000 for law school. Between 1985-2012, private law school tuition increased 440%, 4 times inflation, while public law school tuition rose an astounding 1,005%. We need diverse paths to becoming a lawyer rather than a single elite model. States should loosen accreditation and credentialing requirements to create cheaper qualification routes. Options include eliminating law school requirements while making bar exams more comprehensive, shortening law school to 2 years, creating specialized degrees for underserved areas like public defense law, and reviving apprenticeship models. Unauthorized practice of law, UPL restrictions in all 50 states prohibit non-lawyers from appearing in court or offering legal advice, artificially inflating prices and reducing competition. America lags behind other countries where paralegals, social workers, and notaries routinely handle legal transactions. Medicine offers valuable lessons for legal reform. Despite the critical nature of healthcare, the field has embraced paraprofessionals to deliver quality care at lower costs. Nurse practitioners diagnose conditions, order tests, and prescribe medications, filling primary care gaps. Physician assistants work alongside doctors, while midwives deliver about 1 in 13 American babies with fewer complications and higher satisfaction than obstetricians. Some innovative public defender offices are already demonstrating how non-lawyers can enhance legal services. The Neighborhood Defender Services of Harlem and Bronx Defenders employ teams of lawyers, social workers, investigators, paralegals, and students to address clients' holistic needs. Like battlefield medics who must quickly assess both injury severity and treatment potential, criminal defense requires principled resource allocation. Current triage happens covertly and inconsistently, with overloaded public defenders making ad hoc decisions about which cases deserve attention. More candid triage would separate cases needing full representation from those that don't. The seriousness of charges provides a natural dividing line. Felonies carrying prison terms devastate defendants through incarceration, job and housing loss, family separation, and permanent stigma. For serious cases that still require appointed counsel, resources must be significantly increased. The savings from restricting Gideon's breadth should increase its depth. Defense lawyers need manageable caseloads in the dozens, not hundreds, allowing time to investigate cases properly rather than presuming guilt and pushing pleas. For cases below the seriousness threshold, legislatures should create lawyer-free courts with simplified procedures. Like traffic or small claims courts, these venues could operate without prosecutors or defense attorneys, with judges taking a more active role in questioning witnesses and explaining procedures. The book concludes by challenging the legal profession's equation of lawyers with justice itself. While lawyers may view this approach as defeatist, after 50 years of Gideon falling short, new strategies are needed. The authors position themselves as techno-optimists who believe information technology can bring creative destruction to law, offering cheaper, faster alternatives to traditional legal services. Once we abandon the assumption that more lawyers are the answer, numerous possibilities emerge. Technology has already democratized access to laws through online statutes and court decisions. Services like LegalZoom provide legal documents at a fraction of lawyers' prices. The United Kingdom and Australia offer encouraging examples of legal deregulation. The UK's 2007 Legal Services Act allows non-lawyers to provide legal advice and lawyers to organize in alternative business structures. This has led to innovations like supermarket-based legal services, offering everything from conveyancing to family law at discount prices. America faces a profound justice paradox. In a nation built on justice for all and the rule of law, we've created a legal system so expensive and unwieldy that most citizens cannot afford it. Rather than pursuing failed approaches like increased legal aid or civil Gideon, we must simplify civil justice itself, using technology to build systems around pro se litigants rather than lawyers.